We seek our place in the world. We seek our place in the world and the answers to our hearts' deep questions. As we seek, may our hearts be open to unexpected answers. May the light of our chalice remind us that this is a community of warmth, of wisdom, and welcoming, of multiple and sometimes unexpected truths. A few years ago, Stephen Hawking summed up scientists' prevailing attitude toward the status of life in the universe. The human race is just a chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet, is how he put it. Most physicists and cosmologists would echo Hawking's and regard life as a trivial, accidental embellishment to the physical world, of no particular significance in the overall cosmic scheme of things. But there has always existed a dissenting minority who maintain that life is not merely an incidental byproduct of nature, but a deeply significant part of the cosmic story. The anthropic principle seems to elevate life and mind to a special place in nature. When Brandon Carter introduced the term 30 years ago, he also explored the notion of a strong anthropic principle. Roughly speaking, the version of the principle asserts that the universe must be such as to give rise to observers at some stage in its development. In other words, the laws of physics and the evolution of the universe are in some unspecified manner destined to bring forth life and mind. The strong anthropic principle does not forbid a multiplicity of universes, but it stipulates that universes without life and observers don't exist. In this way, life in general and conscious beings in particular are treated as an active selection mechanism. The same basic idea has been propounded explicitly or implicitly by many distinguished scientists. For example, Freeman Dyson, as we look out into the universe and identify the many accidents of physics and astronomy that have worked together to our benefit, it almost seems as if the universe in some sense have known we were coming. Likewise, the Cambridge biologist Simon Conway Morris says that there is, if you like, seeded into the initiation of the universe itself, the inevitability of intelligence. The strong anthropic principle receives some support from the widespread belief that the emergence of life is somehow inevitable because it is built into the laws of the universe. The Nobel Prize-winning biologist Christian de Duve describes the universe as pregnant with life and calls life a cosmic imperative. The biophysicist Stuart Kaufman echoes Freeman Dyson by declaring that we are at home in the universe. Behind the ambitious astrobiology program funded by NASA and other institutions and the SETI project to seek evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence is the assumption that life is not a freak phenomenon confined to Earth, but a widespread and inevitable outcome of physical laws that are intrinsically slanted in favor of biology. In other words, life is not just a random byproduct of nature, but a fundamental part of the workings of the cosmos. Such a view has an obvious popular appeal, but is it credible? A few weeks ago, Frank Gregorio gave a service in which he talked about the likelihood of extraterrestrial life. His main point was that given the large number of exoplanets that astronomers are finding just about any place they look, and given the sheer vastness of space, our sun is one of hundreds of millions of stars in our galaxy, and our galaxy is one of hundreds of millions of galaxies that stretch over billions of light years. Given the sheer vastness of space, it's almost inevitable that life would crop up somewhere else in the universe. Now, I'd like to focus in on that idea a little bit and ask a couple of questions that stemmed out of that service. And that is, why should there be life anywhere in the universe? And secondly, how abundantly should we expect to find life? Now, let's start by considering the only place where we know for sure that is bio-friendly, and that's Earth. It turns out that our planet is just the right distance from the sun. If it was any further away, the temperature would be much colder, and if it was much closer to the sun, the temperature would be much higher. And has to be set in such a place that water exists as a liquid, because water is essential for life. It's just the right distance for there to be water in the liquid state. And it's just the right size. If it was a little bit bigger, gravity would be stronger and multicellular life would be difficult. And if it was a little bit smaller, gravity might not be able to hold on to our atmosphere. It might just sort of drift out into space. So we are the just right at a Goldilocks distance and a Goldilocks size. But it goes beyond that, because even the atmosphere is just right. There's just the right amount of oxygen. If there was more oxygen in the atmosphere, then oxygen is very reactive, and organic material would simply combust and burn up. And if there was less oxygen, it would make multicellular life, certainly, much more difficult, if not impossible. So we seem to live in a Goldilocks planet. But the Goldilocks nature of our existence goes way beyond our planet. It encompasses the whole universe. If scientists believe that at one point, about 13.7 billion years ago, everything in the universe was in one place, all the matter, all the energy, time, space, everything was condensed down into a single point. And then there was a cataclysmic explosion and everything blew up and started to separate. If gravity had been a little bit stronger, then, or if the rate of expansion had been a little bit less, then that all that material would have condensed back into a big crunch, and the Big Bang would have been followed by a big crunch. And if gravity were a little bit less, or the rate of expansion a little bit faster, then gas clouds wouldn't have formed, and gravity wouldn't have been able to condense those into planets and galaxies and stars. And so our existence depends on a very fine balance between the rate of expansion right after the Big Bang and the gravity. How tight is that critical parameter? If it varied by as little as one part in 100,000,000,000,000, then life as we know it would not exist here on this planet or in the universe. And it's not just gravity and the rate of expansion. Consider the electrostatic force. That's the force that attracts positive and negative particles. The nucleus of an atom is positively charged, we remember, and the electrons negatively charged that surround it, and they're held together by this electrostatic force. If the electrostatic force was a little bit stronger, then electrons would crash into the nucleus. And if it was a little bit weaker, the positively charged protons wouldn't be able to hold on to the electrons. In either way, there wouldn't be atoms. And if we don't have atoms, we can't have molecules. And if we don't have molecules, we don't have complex molecules. And if we don't have complex molecules, we can't have life. And so, but even beyond those two parameters, scientists have been able to identify over 200 other physical and biological parameters that have to be just right in order for us to exist. Now, how is that possible? There's nothing in physics that dictates that gravity and the rate of expansion have to be so exquisitely well balanced. Now, we might be able to accept a couple of improbable parameters, but if you think about the odds of having 200 parameters being perfectly well balanced, then the chances of that happening just by some random process seems almost impossible. In fact, it does seem impossible. Well, one thing we could say is, well, that's just the way it is. But that's not an acceptable scientific answer. Scientists can't say that's just the way it is, because that would destroy any question. Science wants reasons and wants to have some understanding of why things exist the way they do. These observations of all these finely tuned parameters led Brandon Carter in 1960 to put all this together and to coin the phrase the anthropic principle. And what that says essentially is that the universe appears to be set up to support the appearance of life and observers, more importantly than just life, observers, intelligent life. So is that so? The idea was not well accepted in 1960. It still isn't. it's triggered a fierce debate among scientists because it flies in the face of the traditional view of what scientists think about the universe. When I was a young student learning to be a scientist, all of my mentors seemed to have one thing in common. They saw the universe as a mechanistic, deterministic, largely random machine that was simply unfolding according to a large number, but a finite number, of scientific principles and processes and procedures that were observable, measurable, predictable, and eventually explainable. There was no purpose to it. It was random. It had no directionality. It was simply unfolding according to these principles. And furthermore, there was nothing in that, those laws of physics, that would explain life. There was no complex A plus complex B would equal life. And that, I guess, is what triggered Stephen Hawking to observe that we are just chemical scum on an average-sized planet. I take it that Professor Hawking was having a bad day. Because physics be damned, we're here. And how do you explain that? How does science explain that? How does physics explain that? That debate rages on. In their defense, the traditionalists have proposed that one possibility might be something they call the multiverse. That says that this universe is not the only universe, that there is a large number of other universes out there, each one of which might have slightly different or entirely different laws of physics. And we happen to be in the one that is perfectly attuned to life, because where else could we be? But there are several things wrong, I think, with the multiverse idea. First of all, there's not one shred of evidence to support it. Some abstract mathematics, perhaps, which, you know, you say, well, you know, figures don't lie. Yeah, but liars figure. And this may be a case of that. Also, it doesn't really answer the question, because the question of what mechanism allows for life in the universe becomes what mechanism would allow for life in the multiverse. It simply raises it one hierarchical level. Some people have observed that the multiverse might just be a desperate attempt by the traditionalists to hold on to their view of the universe. So the argument has raged for, the debate has raged for over 60 years now, and it seems to be continuing. Although I sense that the anthropic principle seems to be gathering many more adherents. So how might this be resolved by scientists? Well, I don't think there's any chance of proving or disproving the multiverse theory. But if you look at the anthropic principle, one of the predictions that might follow from that is that if the universe is set up to produce life, then we might expect to find life not just hither and yon in the universe, but throughout the universe. We might find life commonly throughout the universe. And indeed, there are a number of scientific projects ongoing right now that are trying to look for life, seek life elsewhere in the universe outside of the Earth. So what are we looking for? Well, life has three essential elements. First of all, it needs a rocky, just right-sized planet with an abundance of elements, especially those that are capable of forming complex molecules such as carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen. It also needs some kind of a liquid in which things can dissolve. On our planet, that's water. But it wouldn't necessarily be water. It could also be liquid methane, or maybe even liquid ethane. And it also needs an external source of energy. For us, most of the time, that involves the sun. But some of our life here on this planet, down in the deep hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean, get their energy from the hydrothermal vents, from the energy that's coming up from the molten core of the planet. So it's not just a star that would be a requirement for this energy. So where are we finding those three elements? Well, one of the places that scientists are looking is Mars. People have speculated that there's life on Mars for hundreds of years. And we're not looking for little green men, we're just looking for any kind of life that might exist there. It's the right distance, it's the right size, it has the right elements. What's been lacking is any kind of water in particular. There are signs that water was once present on the planet, but there's no water there now, at least not on the surface. But NASA just recently announced that they found liquid water on Mars in a subterranean lake buried underneath the surface. That's at least 12 kilometers wide of unknown depth, and it's in the liquid state. So all the elements for life are there. The next job would be to get some kind of rover type instrument to go out there and actually sample that. Again, that would be extremely important if we found life there, because it would show that life could exist on more than one planet in this solar system. And if that's true, then in all these other solar systems that we're finding, life could exist in multiple places as well, perhaps. Scientists are also looking in places in our own solar system, other places. They have flyby satellites now. They're looking at in detail at some of the other planets, and they're particularly interested in some of the moons, some of the larger moons of some of our larger planets. Ganymede is one that's surrounding Jupiter, circling Jupiter. It has water. In fact, estimates are that Ganymede has more water than all the oceans on Earth put together. And evidence is that beneath several kilometers or several hundred kilometers of frozen water, there is liquid water. There are cracks in the surface, and there are jets of liquid that seem to be spewing out of those. It'd be wonderful to go in and sample those to see again if there is microbial life on Ganymede. And Titan is much the same thing. And there's even some talk now that Jupiter has all the right stuff. It's mainly ice also, and may have oceans or lakes of liquid methane, and beneath that maybe oceans of liquid water. So there are other places in our solar system where we could look. And there are all these exoplanets. Now how in the world is science going to sample these planets that are hundreds, sometimes thousands, millions of light years away? Well, it turns out there may be some ways. The Hubble spacecraft is just large enough to sort of see these planets. And what we're looking for is, again, a Goldilocks size planet, Goldilocks distance from a star, maybe with an atmosphere. There's some with looks like a fuzzy boundary that would indicate an atmosphere. Now that stretches Hubble to the limit. But in 2021, we're scheduled to launch the James Webb Space Telescope that will be several times bigger than Hubble. And it should be large enough to actually see these planets in much greater detail. And what we're looking for is an atmosphere. We may be able to determine what chemicals are in that atmosphere. And what we would be looking for would be a just right amount of oxygen. Oxygen is very reactive. It should, over by a few million years, it should have reacted with something. And so if there's a steady state of oxygen in that atmosphere, that is, again, not too much and not too little, that would certainly be suggestive of life. The same thing would be true of methane. If we found methane, a steady state of methane in the atmosphere. Methane can be produced by volcanic eruptions, but if there was a steady state of methane in the atmosphere, then that also would be suggestive of life. So we do have some possibilities. And there's the SETI project, the SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. They're actually listening for radio signals, assuming that if there is intelligent life, they're going to be trying to contact us as we are trying to contact them, and we might be able to find or decipher some kind of radio message coming from those places. So there are plenty of activities now, scientific activities that are actually looking for life elsewhere in the universe. So I could go on and talk about this all day, but in 20 minutes I only have time really to scratch the surface of what is really a complicated and fascinating topic. So I'll wrap it up by leaving you with some of the host of unanswered questions that the anthropic principle raises. And these are questions that are not just being asked by philosophers and theologians and New Age thinkers, but also by scientists, by physicists and cosmologists and quantum physicists and mathematicians and even a few biologists. Does the universe have a purpose? And is that purpose to produce life? Is the universe really fine-tuned for life, or is it just some colossal coincidence? Are we the purpose of the universe? Are we the products of the universe? Or are we, through our intelligence and our consciousness, are we helping to create the universe? If so, just how important is our contribution to creating the universe? Or how important are observers to the universe? And finally, the most interesting and perplexing of all questions, what mechanism could possibly produce a bio-friendly, so finely tuned universe? In 1930, James Jeans, who was a physicist and a mathematician and is known as the father of British cosmology, wrote the following. The stream of knowledge is heading towards a non-mechanical reality. The universe begins to look more like a great thought than like a great machine. Mind no longer appears to be an accidental intruder into the realm of matter. We ought rather to hail it as the creator and governor of the realm of matter. Mind and thought? Whose mind and whose thought? We Unitarians are called, with our fourth principle, to a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Sometimes these searches take us into areas where we had no idea we were going. We end up in places where we have to re-examine what we believe, and in some cases modify those beliefs, or in some cases abandon them altogether. Science is involved in a similar calling. Will the search for truth, stimulated by unexplained observations and relationships, cause traditional science to embrace a more bio-friendly view of the universe? I believe that that's quite possible. Indeed, the times, they may be a changing, even for physicists. May it be so.